particularly this evening, about our beloved guardian, Shug Effendi. We've been very, very greatly blessed and actually amazed at the development of the faith in this part of the world. With the establishment of the Baha'i faith in South Africa, in this difficult area, though it's very difficult, the very fact that it is difficult will bring about great results in the future and will produce great Baha'i teachers and great Baha'i workers. Teaching the cause is disseminating the power of the Holy Spirit. And when you become a teacher of the cause, you become a channel through which the Holy Spirit descends into the world and goes out to those to whom you teach. So that actually the teacher secures greater benefit from his teaching services than the one whom he teaches, because he is then in contact with the power of the Holy Spirit. In the Holy Land, where we, Mrs. Ayos and I, had the privilege of serving the beloved guardian for some 6 years, you learned a little bit of what it meant to be in contact with the Holy Spirit directly, because you were continuously in the presence of the beloved guardian. And as you know, he was like a generator of spiritual power. When you met the guardian, you could just feel his spiritual power of his penetrating right through your very being. And to move continuously in that power and in that force was not an easy thing. It was something to aspire to, but I don't think very many of us actually achieved very much in the way of nearness to his spirit. The power, the unerring guidance of God descended upon Shoghi Effendi at all times and in all things he did. And in all of his ways and his acts and his deeds, you could see the supreme guidance which he was receiving in the carrying on of the Baha'i work. Shoghi Effendi completely dedicated his whole life to the cause of God. He had no other thought. He ate, he slept, he was awake, he worked every minute, day and night, was for the cause of God. He thought of nothing else. Nothing else was of any interest to him. He didn't talk about anything else. He talked about the conditions of the friends, about the services of the friends. And he was like a barometer. When good word came from any part of the world about the successes of the believers, of the teaching work they did, he was joyous and he was happy. But when word came of difficulties within the Baha'i faith, of persecutions of some of the Baha'is, of difficulties the pioneers were meeting with, of suffering of the believers, he became very sad. His heart was like a mirror that seemed to reflect all parts of the world. And wherever he turned his heart, he saw what was there. And he saw pictured before him the exact conditions of the believers themselves. So that if any of you, especially the pioneers, especially those who've come into new areas to teach, and those of you who are carrying on this teaching work in new areas, if you have any idea that you're alone, that God is not with you, that the power of the Holy Spirit is not with you, dispel that from your mind, because the power of God and the power of the Holy Spirit is with you all the time, every minute, day and night. And the guardian himself, even in his physical form, registered those things in the Holy Land. And he talked to us about them day after day and night after night. I want to give you just one day in the guardian's life so you can appreciate a little bit more of what it is to be the head of the faith, of a faith like the Baha'i faith. Shoghi Effendi usually arose in the morning about 5:30. And then he had his period of prayer and devotions and meditation. After that, he would receive, or he still had the pile of mail from yesterday or the day before, piles of mail. And he would start to go through this mail from all over the world. And he would indicate on each letter what should be done with it. One of the things that interested me very much, because I come from a business background and had a large office and had lots of mail, I never opened my own mail. It was always handled by someone else. But Shoghi Effendi opened every letter that was addressed to him. Anyone who wrote a letter to Shoghi Effendi and addressed to Shoghi Effendi, that was opened by the guardian himself. And he took out the letter and he read it, and then he indicated and instructed what should be done with it. Sometimes he gave to respond to, sometimes he gave it to me, other times he gave it to Dr. Hakim, if it were to the Oriental countries, and had to be answered in Persian. So every piece of mail that came in addressed to the guardian of the cause was received by him personally and was opened by him personally, so that everyone was assured that their messages to him caught his own eye and his own heart and his own mind. Then after going through this correspondence for hours, and don't think it was light, one evening he came over and he says, "Today I received 700 pages of minutes and of records from different parts of the world, and I have to read them all." Now that came for another day, not in that volume, but I just mentioned this volume so we have an idea of what it was just to read the mail, let alone consider what to be done with all of the questions that were asked, and to issue the instructions about what should be done all over the world. The early afternoon he went up on Mount Carmel into the Baha'i gardens there, which he had built himself, and he met the Oriental pilgrims. He walked with them in the gardens, he talked with them, he had tea with them, he answered their questions, he talked about the cause in all parts of the world, particularly in the Orient, what should be done, this problem, that problem, the other problem. And then he would lead them into the shrine. And after a period of prayer and devotion there in which he chanted for them, they would return. Then he would come down and continue with his mail and his cables that have come in during the day, answer the cables. Then in the evening he would come over and have dinner with the pilgrims from the western part of the world and with the members of the International Baha'i Council. Then he would talk about the cause with the people from the west. He talked with them in English. Khashoggi Effendi spoke a number of languages, English and Persian and Arabic very well. And he would talk about the cause, the different conditions all throughout the world, and talk with them about the progress of the faith in their own country. And one of the most interesting things that we experienced was when a pilgrim would come, let's say, from Canada. He'd say, "Well, how is the cause developing in Canada? How is it progressing? How many centers do you have? How many spiritual assemblies do you have? And how many groups do you have?" "Well, Shoghi Effendi, I don't know." "Well," he says, "you don't know. I do know. I'll tell you what it was. It makes no difference what country, whether it was Swaziland or South Africa." He would tell you the number of assemblies here, the number of groups, the number of Baha'is, the condition of the cause. Any part of the world made no difference. So he talked with each and every one about their own country, about the conditions there, about the social conditions, about the problems under which they work, and give them hope and encouragement and guidance and instructions. And then he would take that occasion to talk over many of the problems with the International Council. Because Shoghi Effendi was not a person that had very many secrets. He allowed no one to speak of any of the things that happened in the Holy Land or actually any of the personal discussions that took place at the table with the pilgrims. But the business of the cause around the Holy Land, he usually talked at that time and gave his instructions. And it was very interesting. His instructions were always right. One time I was handling a certain matter for the Guardian with the government authorities. Mr. Ober was there, and he will remember it. And I was telling the Guardian, he asked me what I was doing, and I told him. He says, "Well, I think you better go and see Mr. Eitan. He's our friend, and he'll help us." Now, that didn't seem the wise thing to me to do, because I'd been handling it along a different line. And I explained it to the Guardian. He says, "No, I think Eitan is our friend. You see him." Well, actually, Eitan is the one that solved the whole problem for us later on. I went to him and appealed to him very strongly, and he settled it. I mention this to show the guidance of the Guardian and how, in all things, he was making decisions all the time. You send him a cable from South Africa, he considers it, he prays about it, and then he gives you the answer, and that's the will of God. And that's the way it works. Well, when I give you this as a picture of one day in Shoghi Effendi's life. Remember, it wasn't one day and then he rested for a week. It wasn't 2 days and then he rested. But it was 3 days, it was 4 days, it was 5 days, it was 6 days, it was 7 days. And it was day week after week and week after week. When he was in the Holy Land, there was no rest whatsoever for the Guardian. From early morning, 5:30 in the morning, till 11:30 at night. Burdened, problems all over the world. People never thought to, until the last few years, to send him the encouraging word of what had been done, the great victories that had been won. But whenever they have any trouble, then they were cabled to Guardian for guidance, and he had to solve the problems of the world in that way, so that he was continuously under the pressure of the friends at all times. When I first arrived in the Holy Land, there were two or three things about the Guardian that impressed me very much. And one was particularly the size of the Guardian. Now, in the West, for you people who haven't been in the West, we've come to associate the idea of majesty and of greatness with size. A man to be a great person and a great leader had to be a big man. 6 feet tall, big shoulders and so on. Shoghi Effendi was a very delicate and refined man. He was small in stature. He was so refined and delicate, his features, his nose, his eyes, his hands. Every one of his features was so delicate and so refined, so perfect, that you could realize that the power when he spoke was not of a man, Shoghi Effendi, but was of the power of the Spirit coming through him. It was a channel that God used. It was not a man sitting there. I used to sit and marvel at the guardian. So refined and so delicate, so beautiful. And yet the power with which he spoke, and when he would speak about the power of the cause, this building would just shake. The whole thing would shake. It was a tremendous experience to see how God can use a chosen instrument to speak through and to work through and to disseminate his will and his power throughout the world. Shoghi Effendi was about the size, was smaller than Abdu'l-Bahá. You've all seen pictures of Abdu'l-Bahá. Shoghi Effendi was smaller than Abdu'l-Bahá. He looked quite a bit like Abdu'l-Bahá. He walked like the master. He had the same stance as the master. One time I was on top of the shrine and we were building the top of the shrine of the Bab. And I looked down, and the guardian was coming into the gardens, and the sun was shining on him. And as I looked down, I said, "Goodness gracious, there's Abdu'l-Bahá." And then I looked again, of course, and it was the guardian. But if he'd had a beard on, a white beard, I'd have sworn it was the master, because it was the same walk, the same stance, the same look. He had the same features in his face, generally, as Abdu'l-Bahá, which means he had quite a few of the features of Baha'u'llah. And when you see the picture of Baha'u'llah, you'll see some of those features. His eyes and the construction of his eyes were those like the Bab. You know that he was the descendant of both Baha'u'llah and of the Bab. And his hands are most delicate and graceful hands. Fact of the matter is, they tell the story that when he was a child, the greatest holy leaf, who was Abdu'l-Bahá's sister, and who we look upon as the most holy and most perfect woman in the Baha'i world, the greatest holy lady used to hold him in her lap, and hold his hands, and she'd say, "These are the hands of Baha'u'llah." The guardian was always a very serious and yet a very delightful character. Even when he was small, he showed his signs of power and of greatness. And Abdu'l-Bahá used to insist that everyone called him Shoghi Effendi. They never allowed him to call him Shoghi like you do with children, using just their first name. But he insisted that they use his title of Effendi, Shoghi Effendi. Even his father and mother had to call him Shoghi Effendi. And Abdu'l-Bahá called him Shoghi Effendi. And he always used to, they say, used to pat him on the head and call him his little house of justice. To show that even from childhood, Abdu'l-Bahá had indicated that he would be the successor to Abdu'l-Bahá and would become the head of the faith. Another one of the qualities that you found in Shoghi Effendi, and which actually astonished me, was his humility. I had studied a lot in the writings about humility. I had read a lot in the religious teachings about being humble. And I thought I knew a little bit about what it meant. But you knew nothing about humility till you saw Shoghi Effendi. Shoghi Effendi never spoke of himself. And one of the things that interested me very much, when he was talking about the cause and its development, he'd speak about the conditions in the days of the Bab. He'd speak about the conditions and the activities of the faith in the days of Baha'u'llah. And he'd speak about the conditions and the activities of the faith in the days of Abdu'l-Bahá. And then he would speak about the faith in the days after Abdu'l-Bahá. He never said in the days of the Guardian or in my period of administration. But he always referred to the days after Abdu'l-Bahá. One time we were talking, and I made some comment to the guardian about some of the activities of the cause. I don't remember what it was, and I mentioned his name in the same sentence and almost in the same vein of thought as that of the master. And he stopped me immediately and says, "Roy, don't ever do that. Don't ever mention my name in the same breath as you mention the name of the master." The master was like the ocean. I'm like a drop. The master was like the sun, and I'm like an atom. So don't ever, ever mention my name. The same theme or the same trend of thought of that of the master. The vast gulf between Abu-Baha and all the rest of creation and between the guardians. Another thing that interested me very much was during the 10-year crusade particularly. We were there serving him during the crusade. He never referred to the crusade as his plan, that it was something that he had given to the friends, that it was something that he had worked out for the friends to work and to accomplish. But he always spoke about the crusade as the task which God has given us to do, just like he had no part of the crusade whatsoever, that he was a channel through which the power of the Spirit flowed and gave this procedure to the world. And he had no more to do with it than anyone else, except that he happened to be the channel. So he always spoke of the tasks which we have to do, including himself in those who have to fulfill the obligations of the 10-year crusade. Then he was a mountain and an ocean of love and of tenderness and of generosity. It was amazing to me how he never forgot the least little thing. I mean things that we would consider completely unimportant. He would comment on something. And you think, well, that was very beautiful. 2 or 3 weeks later, he'd say, Leroy, I told you about so-and-so that day. And he said, now this is the rest of it. Things that you dismiss from your mind, the least little thing, the God who never forgot anything, even the smallest thing. And as you go about, you'd always be complimenting someone. The gardeners, even the gardeners taking care of the garden, you say, well, you planted that very beautifully. The flowers are very beautiful. I'm well pleased with the way you're keeping up this lawn. And I'd like you to do so-and-so. And it's just very beautiful. Everyone who worked for him, he was always thinking what he could say to make them happy. And when a person was having difficulty, he would say, what can I do to make that person happy? What can I do to lighten his load so that he can carry on a little bit better and a little more efficient? Never thinking of himself. How he had time with all the problems, mind you, of all the world all the time, to be thinking of all these little things, all of those things which he did. It was amazing. His love. And he loved people. He loved everyone. He looked in everyone. He saw the face of God in everyone. He looked at their attributes of God. He looked at their accomplishments. He looked at their deeds. He didn't look at their shortcomings. What registered before the guardian was what a person was offering to God and not his sins and shortcomings. Accomplishments, the good deeds, the character that he had developed. That's what the guardian saw. He didn't see the other things. He wasn't interested in them. Always ready to forgive. Always ready to help. So this love of the guardian, this tenderness, this gentleness, and yet a man who has to rule the world and root it with iron. It's a combination that is almost inconceivable, that a person would be so full of love and tenderness, and a tenderness that you can't understand. No one will realize how he suffered from things, the mistreatment of some of the members of his family. Nobody knows what he suffered. You had to be there to see it. And then he never said anything, but you could feel his suffering from those who had turned away from the cause of his own kith and kin. Very difficult, because his love was so great, his forgiveness was so great, and his forbearance was so great. This gentleness and this consideration and this love, I want to tell you just two little stories. One of them, there was a pilgrim from the United States, a Mrs. True. The American Baha'is, of course, who were here, remember her very well. One of the very early Baha'is in the cause, one of the great workers for the Baha'i Temple, one of the great pillars of the cause, and she's now a hand of the cause. She visits the guardian. She's 95 years old. And, of course, the guardian was greatly pleased that she'd come at that age. And he would talk to her about the early days of the cause, about the days of the master, and what the master had said to her, and what she had done for the master, and so on. One evening he came over and he said, sat down with Miss True. He says, I have a gift for you tonight. And she was quite excited, of course. Being elderly, a little bit nonplussed as to what to do. And he took it out of his coat pocket. He reached in and took out. And he says, this is a purse which Abu-Baha used. And I know you treasure it and like it because it's from him. And she thanked him and was quite upset, quite excited about it. And he says, open it and see what's in it. So So she started to open it and fumbling around, trying to meet it. He says, let me open it for you. She took it and opened it. And she says, look in there now. What's there? She says, well, she says, there's a gold piece in there. Yes, he says, take it out and look at it. So she looked out and he looked at it. He says, now, what's the date of it, Mrs. True? She looked at it. He says, 1906. He says, that's the date of your first visit to the Holy Land to visit Abu Baha. And this was a gold coin which Abu Baha had. Well, now, think of that tenderness with all of the weight that he has on his shoulders, all of the problems he has to meet, that he would think of those things. He would think of this purse. He would think of that gold piece back, and he would think of the date of her first visit, 1906. Well, another story I'll tell you that has touched me very much and was very impressive. There was the one of the pilgrims from Canada, who member of the National Assembly. And it was the day, night before her departure for returning home to Canada. And she was talking to him about translating the Baha'i literature into the Eskimo language. You see, up in the north of Canada, there are lots of Eskimos. In the north of Canada, it's snow and ice all the time. They never have the warm sunshine like you have here. It never gets warm. They never have these beautiful flowers. And they never have the beautiful birds which you have. So she asked Shoghi Effendi for permission in translating the Baha'i literature for the Eskimos to use designations of things in the writings which were familiar to the Eskimos. For instance, she said in the writings, Baha'u'llah speaks about the nightingale and the rose. Now, she said up in the Eskimo country, they don't know what a nightingale is, and they don't know what a rose is. So can we use the word penguin, for instance, or some flower which grows some of the ice flowers which grow in those north lands. Shoghi Effendi said, when you are translating any literature about the cause, written by other than the Prophet or Abdul Baha, yes, you can change and use any illustrations you want. But when you translate Baha'u'llah's words or Abdul Baha's words or the Bab's words, you translate them exactly as they are. You can't change anything. And you have to translate nightingale and rose for the Eskimos. Well, the next night when the guardian came over and was bidding her goodbye, he reached in his coat pocket again and he brought out a bottle of attar of rose, a very rich oil of rose, the best, most beautiful perfume of rose that there is, the richest. And he said, I give you this attar of rose so that when you return to Canada, you can anoint the friends on my behalf and give them all my love. And then in a minute or two, he reached in his pocket and he took out another bottle of attar of rose. And he says, this bottle is for the Eskimos. He says, when you make any Eskimos Baha'is, you anoint them with this attar of rose and give them my love. And in that way, they'll become acquainted with the rose of Persia. Well, it was things like that all the time. How the guardian ever thought of these matters is difficult to conceive, how he encompassed it in the period of 24 hours. From early morning, late at night, pressure, problems. Sometimes he comes so nervous that he couldn't eat because of some of the problems confronting the Baha'is in different parts of the world. Certain things had to be decided. Certain things had to be done. I'll speak of one or two of them later, perhaps. But this was the life of the guardian, his tenderness. Now, another thing that interested me very much and was a lesson to me, it was the same lesson that Abdul Baha gave the Baha'is who were around him in his days, but the spiritual insight of Shoghi Effendi. He wasn't interested in the man. He wasn't interested in the clothes. He was interested in the character and his devotion to the cause. And there was a knock on the door at the Western Pilgrim House, and I went to the door, and the man was very poorly dressed and rather a nondescript appearance. And I said, yes. I said, what can we do for you? Anything we can do for you? He says, I am Charles Dunning. I am the pioneer from the Orkney Islands. Well, I said, come right in. And I welcomed him in. I took him to his room, made him comfortable, and saw that he had fruit and one thing and another. And then he was busy during the day, and it came time. The guardian usually came over for dinner to at dinner time to receive the pilgrims, the new pilgrims that had come, and to have dinner with them and talk with them. And so, to us, it's a very important event. I mean, every time you saw the guardian was a new event. It wasn't that you saw him this morning and you see him this evening. It was a new occasion. It's hard to describe the guardian. You were so close to him that you couldn't be any closer. And yet you were so far that you couldn't be any further, because there was no association with the infallibility of the guardian. That was always there. And there's no association for that guidance which comes. He's the only one. I used to feel so sorry for Shoghi Effendi, I can't tell you. Problems and problems, and he had no one to consult with. No one to share these burdens with him. He had to decide for himself. He had to consider for himself, and he had to make the decision himself. Because there was no associate for this divine guidance. What it was, we don't know. I don't know what it is and how it worked, but there it was. You saw it all the time. Well, I said to Charles, we were getting ready to go down to have dinner with the guardian, and I said, well, Charles, don't you think maybe you want to change your clothes and a little bit for the guardian? He says, yes, I wishes, I will. So we went down, and I noticed he had the same clothes, which, of course, was all right. But when he came in, the guardian put his arms around him and kissed him. Now, the guardian very seldom kissed anyone. He embraced everyone, but very seldom, but he kissed him. And he sat him down at the head of the table, next to him. He says, you're a knight of Baha'u'llah, and you deserve to be at the head of this table. Spiritual insight the guardian saw in that man, his sacrifice for the cause, his devotion to the cause, his service in those difficult Orkney Islands. You think you have a difficult here? Nothing compared with the Orkney Islands, I'll tell you. People there are hard. People there are disinterested in religion. It's a cold, miserable country. There's nothing that lends itself. Here you anyway have the sunshine, you have the flowers, and you have your own associates, but he was there singly and alone, serving in that cold, bleak place, and I think the people were colder than the weather. It's terrible. And the guardian realized it. And the guardian felt that he said, after he left, he says, he is one of the God's heroes of the present time. I mention this so you can see how Shoghi Effendi saw this insight into everyone, this tenderness, this love. And yet, friends, a precision of mind. You can't conceal the precision of Shoghi Effendi's mind. I've dealt in America with high executives all in my business life. Men who have to problem and they size it up and they see the meat and the heart of the situation immediately. But they were children alongside of Shoghi Effendi. He would get long letters from various parts of the world, and they'd be diffusive in their love for the guardian, their devotion to the guardian, and what can they do to serve the guardian, and then two or three pages of questions. And he would read them, and he'd say, but why don't they tell me what they want to know? They keep talking all around the subject instead of the heart. He says, I don't have time to read all these pages. He'd hand it to me, and he says, you correspond with him, find out exactly what the question is, and then give it to me, and I'll give him the answer. Minor precision you never saw. He was small in stature. He was tender. He was kind. He was loving. But I tell you, the precise mind and how he suffered from the inefficiency of the Baha'is. He used to get letters from other people in National Assembly, and he'd say, these people are mountains, oceans of devotion, but mountains of inefficiency. Everything he did was efficient. Everything he did had to be have a result immediately. And I soon learned when I was there, and when you start to talk to him about anything, ask you any questions. There's no use going into all the details. Well, I went to Jerusalem and I saw Mr. Smith and I talked with him. No. You say, Mr. Smith said so-and-so in Jerusalem, and that's all. Then he gives you the answer. Wasn't interested in details. Only interested in the heart of every subject. And in the heart, he gave you the answer and gave it immediately. If the heart wasn't there, he recognized it. Well, this was a sort of a general picture of Shoghi Effendi. Now, you ask, and I've been asked, and I ask myself, what was this infallible guidance of the guardian? Many people have asked me, if I've gone from place to place, when did the physical part of Shoghi Effendi end and the spiritual part begin? When did Shoggy Effendi end and the Guardian begin? I had an experience. I'll tell you two experiences I had, and then you will see how this thing worked and how it worked over the world. The Guardian was talking one night about the administrative order of the faith and how it evolved and how it would grow. And I think the question resolved itself as something between the National Assemblies and the Universal House of Justice when it's formed. I don't remember the exact question. But as the Guardian was talking, I made a mental note. And then as he talked, I made this mental note. I said, now, under certain circumstances, that won't work. And when the Guardian finishes talking, I'm going to ask permission to ask him to elucidate the matter further. So he went on talking and finally finished his discourse. He took a sip from his cup of coffee. Then he turned to me and he says, now, under certain circumstances, you wouldn't think that would work. But he says, I'll explain to you how it does work. I don't know. It's very difficult when you realize that the Guardian knows these things. When he wants to know them, you have to keep your mind pretty pure all the time. Another time, he came over for dinner, and he was rather disturbed. He'd had some cables from America about certain matters, and some action that had been taken, and he was a little disturbed at the action which was taken, actually. He started to talk about it, discuss it, and he read the cable that had been received. And in a minute or two, he turned to me and says, Roy, he says, you were on the National Assembly in America when this thing happened, when it first came up, weren't you? And I said, yes, sir, I was. He says, you tell me what happened at that first meeting. So I started to tell him what happened. He stopped me when I got about one-fifth of the way. He said, no, no, no. He says, I will tell you what happened, and then you tell me if I'm right or wrong. So then he proceeded to discuss that meeting, what had taken place, the spirit behind the actions which were taken, which was the thing I was trying to convey to him, because an action is simple. You know, you did this, but why did you do it? That's the important thing. The spirit behind it. And he described that in detail. He said to me, am I right or am I wrong? I said, Shoggy Effendi, you were right, even to the details. He says, you see, I don't have to have all this information. God gives me a feeling in my heart. When I have that feeling and I have it strong, I know what the situation is, and it doesn't make any difference what anybody says, what anybody does, how much they give me or how much they say. That's the situation, and I know it. And in any part of the world, it's the same thing. We had one time a message came from one National Assembly, from a member of the National Assembly, very severely criticizing another member of the National Assembly and blaming him for certain things that had been done. Shoggy Effendi sent a cable back to that person. He says, no, that one you're criticizing is not a, you're responsible. The one who wrote the letter criticizing is you're responsible, not him. And you should stop it immediately. Well, there you have infallible guidance. All parts of the world. People give him misleading, wrong information. Yet he knew the correct answer. He had these feelings. Came in his heart, and whenever he had that feeling, he said, I know it's right, because God has guided me to it. And that's the infallible guidance in any part of the world. And everyone is fine when they found when they follow the Guardian's instructions. They found that they always came out correctly. Now, people have asked, did the Guardian have any conception that he was going to pass away? Did he have foreknowledge, being divinely guided, that he was going to pass away? Again, friends, the question is that you don't know. The preponderance of evidence would seem to be that he did not know and that he did not expect to pass away. But I give you these instances. They're very sad. But I think you should know it and would want to know them. One evening, Shoggy Effendi came over. He was rather, hadn't been well. He was rather disturbed, badly disturbed, in fact. And he sat down, pushed his plate aside. Rhea Connum said, Shoggy Effendi, won't you eat? You haven't eaten all day. You're hungry. You're getting weak. You should eat. He says, eat, and then talk to the friends later about your cablegrams and the matters you want to talk about. So he said, well, all right. And he pulled his plate back, and the servant gave him some food. He ate one or two mouthfuls, then he pushed it back, and then he started to talk. Well, Shoghi Effendi, those who lived there, you got so you could, you knew without anyone telling you whether Shoghi Effendi was well or whether he was happy. You just, the whole life in Haifa surrounded Shoghi Effendi. And if he was well, you get up in the morning, you're feeling fine. If he was happy, everything was sunshine. Sometimes you get up in the morning, everything was wrong. Why was it wrong? You don't know why it was wrong, but you found out during the day that Shoghi Effendi wasn't well. So this evening, when he pushed his plate aside, and again without eating, then he started to talk. And he said, you know, shortly before Baha'u'llah passed away, the master went to see him in Baji, went up to his room, and he found his papers all over the floor. So the master collected them, put them in a neat order, laid them on the divan next to Baha'u'llah, and he says, Baha'u'llah, I've collected your papers, I put them in order, and I put them right here so that you can have them. Baha'u'llah took them in his hand and threw them all over the floor again. He says, don't make any difference, it's all done. I don't want the papers anymore. No more papers. That was shortly before Baha'u'llah passed away. So he said, when Abu Baha, shortly before Abu Baha passed away, Abu Baha was very meticulous in everything he did. And they found his papers scattered around in his room. His secretaries collected them and put them in order for them, put them together. And they brought him to Abu Baha, and he took them and threw them. He says, I'm done with the papers, makes no difference, it's all finished now. I don't want any more papers. And shortly after, he passed away. He says, I am getting so tired of my papers, I don't want it anymore. He says, I just don't want these papers anymore. I don't want them. Well, we have come to Shoghi Effendi. Don't talk that way. How can you say these things? You're going to kill your friends here. And I said, Shoghi Effendi, why don't you give these papers to Riyad Khan and myself? Give them to us. We'll do something with them. We'll handle them. We'll digest them. We'll give you memorandums. So all you have to do is give us the answers. If a person raises a question, we give it to you. And all you have to do is say, tell them so-and-so. Tell them so-and-so. I said, and Shoghi Effendi, no guardian in the cause in the future is going to be able to do what you do. No guardian can receive all these people, give them personal audiences, personal contacts, answer personal questions, deal with their personal problems. So they have to, in the future, deal through the mediaries. And I said, why don't you just set up now and have an audience with pilgrims one hour in an afternoon? Just 1 hour and talk to everyone and have a general talk and then it's all finished so you can have a little time, so you can rest a little bit, so you don't have so many burdens, so you're not so pressed. And we talked along that line and Shoghi Effendi said, well, it is not time for any change now. That was it. Sometime later, I usually had the privilege of walking home with the guardian after he left the pilgrims. And very often he talked further about the subject he'd been discussing at dinner and gave further amplification, which, of course, were very precious, precious moments and precious things. So, that evening he'd been talking about spiritual matters. It was the most spiritual talk that I'd ever heard. The guardian gave all the time I was in Haifa. Seemed like he was opening a door into heaven and letting us look in a little while. And, of course, I was hoping as we walked home he was going to continue talking about this subject and perhaps give some more elucidation. When he got halfway over, he turned around and he says, Leroy, he says, you know, I've been guardian of the cause for 36 years. He says, the weight and the responsibility and the worries are just weighting me down. He said, in the days of the Bab, the cause was established in two countries. In the days of Baha'u'llah, in 11 countries. The days of Abu Baha in 31 countries. Today it's in 250 countries and islands of the world. He says, I have so many things weighing me down. I have to consider the future of the cause. I have to consider the welfare of the cause in every country. And I have all of these burdens, this correspondence, all of this work all the time. And it's just weighing me down and I have got to have relief. Well, I said, Shoghi Effendi, why don't you give me those papers? I can do a lot more work than I'm doing. I'll have to have a lot of help in my office. I've got to have more help to do the things I'm doing, but I can take these things. I can take those papers. I can digest them. I can tell you what the questions are. All you have to do is give the answer, and we'll give the answers. I said, that'll give you some relief. And he turned with tears in his eyes, and he said, only God can give me relief. Now, was he telling us that he was soon to leave us? I don't know. It never dawned on us for a moment that that's what he was doing. We thought perhaps he was sick. We knew he was overburdened. We were all trying to do everything we could to relieve him. And yet, when he was away, as you know, when he passed away in England, I had many cables from him, many letters from him, things he wanted to be done, things he wanted to finish by the time he got back because of things he wanted to do. And he said he can't do until other things are finished. He wanted me to press the government, press different sources in order to finish them. For instance, one thing which is very important, he considered one of the most important accomplishments of the past years, was the freeing of the most holy place in the Baha'i world, the Baiji and the Shrine of Baha'u'llah, freeing it from the poisonous and insidious influence of the covenant breakers who lived right next to the shrine, which I was working on. Finally, we got the people disposed. We got the people out of these buildings. We got title to the buildings, and I cabled the guardian. I asked him if, because he had said he wanted them destroyed immediately, that they were out of the buildings. So I cabled him that we now had the titles transferred to the American NSA, their Israel branch, and should we proceed with the destruction of this building, these buildings. And he cabled back. He says, no. He said, hold that lie return. I want to supervise the destruction of the building, those buildings. Well, there was a direct statement of certain things he wanted to do. Now, certain other things he wanted to do in Haifa, certain other things he wanted to do in Acre, that he'd asked me to arrange details for so that he could handle when he got back. It seems likely that if he had knowledge that he was going to pass away, he would have given us some written instructions as to what should be done after his ascension. Of course, you all know that the book, The Dispensation of Baha'u'llah, he considered that his will and testament. And he told many of the friends that, in reality, this is my will and testament, so that after me, no differences may occur. I want to say a few words now about the guardianship. I've told you about the life of the guardian, his guidance, his foreknowledge. Shoghi Effendi was a very remarkable young man. And, of course, he just worshipped Abdu'l Baha. And when Abdu'l Baha passed away, the whole world became dark for him. All light had gone out. When he returned to the Holy Land, he had in mind, from the things which Abdu'l Baha had said to him, and I am now telling you what he said, I had in mind that Abdu'l Baha would give me the honor of calling the great conclave, calling together the great conclave, which would elect the Universal House of Justice. And I thought in his will and testament that that was probably what he was instructing be done. But he said, instead of that, I found that I was appointed the guardian of the cause of God. He said, I didn't want to be the guardian of the cause. First place, I didn't think I was worthy. Next place, I didn't want to face these responsibilities. I think he talked along this line one night when you were there, John. I'm not sure, but he talked in more detail another time to us. Great detail. He said, I didn't want to be the guardian. I knew what it meant. I knew that my life as a human being was over. He said, I didn't want it, and I didn't want to face it. So, as you remember, I left the Holy Land. And I went up in the mountains of Switzerland. And I fought with myself until I conquered myself. Then I came back and I turned myself over to God, and I was the guardian. Now, he said, every Baha'i in the world, every person in the world has to do exactly that same thing. Whether you're a hand of the cause, whether you're a knight of Baha'u'llah, whether you're a member of a national assembly, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a pioneer, whether you're an administrator, regardless of what you are, whatever you're doing in the cause, every Baha'i must fight with himself and conquer himself. And when he has conquered himself, then he becomes a true instrument for the service of the cause of God. And not until then. And he won't achieve his great success until he has done it. And this is what every Baha'i in the world should know. And this is one of the main things I want you to get out of this talk tonight and bear out of this talk. The Guardian's instructions that every individual must fight with himself, must conquer himself, must overcome his lower nature, must overcome himself, and turn himself over to God so that the Holy Spirit can function through you. And when the Holy Spirit functions through you, then you'll gain victory after victory. Because the Holy Spirit is the creative aspect of God, and it cannot do other than win victories and make successes for the cause. When Shoghi Effendi then became guardian, he found that he had before him certain specific tasks. One, the Lai's mission in life was to fulfill those things which Abdu'l-Bahá had started and wished to be finished, such as the Shrine of the Bab, such as the building of the terraces on Mount Carmel, such as the building of the gardens on Mount Carmel surrounding the shrine, such as getting land and property surrounding the Shrine of Baha'u'lláh, and beautifying that most sacred resting place. And all of these things he started immediately to do, and he did. And now we have on Mount Carmel, we have more properties surrounding the Shrine of the Bab and protecting our holy places and sites for our administrative buildings of the future and areas of the future more than we need. And the same way in Baji, surrounding the home of Baha'u'llah, the mansion of Baha'u'llah, and surrounding the shrine, which is the Qibla of the Baha'i world, the most sacred place in the Baha'i world, and now, thank the Lord, is purified from the evils of the enemies of the cause. More property there than we anticipated. The guardian accomplished this. And then he saw as his mission three things. One, in the administrative field, to build up the administrative order of the cause. Secondly, to spread the teachings of the cause throughout the world. That was another one of his missions. And lastly, to build the world center of the faith in the Holy Land. These were the three things that dominated him, four things that dominated his life and his activity. I speak to you just two little elements, and then I close. One is in the administrative field. Those of us who were in the cause since the early days, I don't want you to think that I'm too old, but I remember very clearly the development of the cause in America, particularly. From the early days, Harlan remembers the development. He's not as old as I am. But while I was young, I was very impressive, and I can remember the things that happened in the cause when I was 4 or 5 years old. I remember Mr. Abulfazl visiting America. I attended the first meeting of the Baha'i Temple Unity when it was organized in 1909. You remember the same day that the remains of the Bab were interred in the shrine on Mount Carmel. So I remember very clearly this development and how the guardian built up this cause from shoots growing everywhere into a perfectly organized unit all over the world. It really is it's matchless when people in the future write about what Shoghi Effendi did in building up the unity and the order of the friends throughout the world. There'll be nothing in history that'll read like it. Abdu'l-Bahá said that we are doing in one generation what takes you normally 1,000 years for humanity to achieve. And Shoghi Effendi was the leader that did it. And we were speaking one night, and I said, Shoghi Effendi, I said, you know, the way that I was a Baha'i in America, where the administrative order was born and grew and developed, I said, I know what was accomplished. I said, the matchless way in which you did this thing. I said, it's almost the work of a genius, the way you accomplished and built this cause and what it is today. He said, Leroy, he says, you talk like you think that I sat over here in the Holy Land and I had a blueprint of this Baha'i world order and that I started to build it. As soon as I found the friends strong enough to do this, I said, build this wall. And then a little later, I said, build that wall. And then build this wall. And then lay that floor. He says, if you had that idea, he says, dismiss it from your mind. He says, when I became guardian, I didn't know what the steps to be taken were. God guided me. And when he gave me guidance, I did what he guided me to do. And very often, I didn't know what the next step was going to be until I got the guidance. When I got the guidance, we did it. And I didn't know maybe what the next step was going to be. I might have thought what it was going to be, but I didn't know till I got the guidance, and then I did it. He says, I have supreme guidance, supreme confidence, that God will guide me to do whatever is necessary for the cause whenever it should be done. And he says, the Baha'is of the world must have exactly that same confidence. They must have confidence that God will guide the guardian to do what should be done for the welfare of the cause at the moment it should be done. And unless they have that confidence, the cause cannot succeed. And this is the second message I want to give you, friends. This confidence which the guardian had in the unrelying, unending guidance of God. We ourselves have to have the reliance. We have to be assured within ourselves that God will guide his cause and that the things will be done when they're to be done, how they're to be done. The unerring guidance of God has not left us. Shug Effendi has not left us. He's left his physical body, but his spirit is still directing the affairs of this great crusade. And if we keep our hearts pure, if we keep our hearts as a mirror through which the power of the Spirit can reflect itself, we will be guided to win this great crusade. Now I end with one story in the teaching work. And it's a direct message to each and every one of us. The guardian came over one evening, and he was very happy and very enthused. He says, we have some wonderful cables today. So he read this cable, and it was from one of the islands in the Pacific. Now, the pioneer who had been there had been very discouraged, had great difficulty. And four different times had written the guardian that he wanted to leave. He couldn't get a job. It was hard to make any contacts. It was harder to make an impression on anyone. No one would listen to him. He was oppressed. He was opposed by the clergy. He was oppressed by the government, and everything was against him. And each time that he wrote these letters, the guardian would tell me to write him and encourage him and tell him that the guardian wanted him to stay and that the guardian promised him that the seeds he was sown would grow. Well, these cables had been received that he not only had one spiritual assembly, but he had two spiritual assemblies. He just burst right out like that. And I said, well, Shug Effendi, I said, this pioneer, he did the work, but I said, the guardian is the one that actually won this victory. I said, you're the one that won it, because if it hadn't been for you, he'd have left. And he says, that's right. He says, Leroy, I tell you, I have to stay in the Holy Land. This is my seat of operations. The friends must do the work. And I tell you that if the friends will do what I have told them to do, and if they will follow my instructions, they will be amazed at the victories which I will win through them. This is the most important message I give to you. Shug Effendi said, if the friends will do what he has told them to do, if they will consecrate their lives to the cause, if they will turn their lives over to the cause, if they will serve the cause diligently in the way in which he told them to serve, he says, they will be amazed at the victories that they will win, that I will win through them. And it's a particularly appropriate name, the way he mentioned it, to tell the friends. It seems to me it's particularly appropriate at this moment, when the Spirit is released and he can operate far more effectively through us than he could before. Well, friend Shug Effendi, I told you about these stories about the Attar of Rose, how he liked to send his love to all of the friends with the Attar of Rose, which was so cherished by Baha'u'llah and by Abdul Baha. And I have brought with me tonight some Attar of Rose, which the guardian gave me to anoint the friends. So I thought it would be nice to anoint each one of you on behalf of Shug Effendi and with his love and with a prayer that we will all do our part to win all of the great goals prescribed for us in the 10-year crusade.